You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, one of the founders of the satirical news outlet, The Onion, will join us to talk about comedy and the line between funny and offensive. Now, the cost of renting in Wisconsin is going up, making it harder for some people to find and afford a place to rent. Part of the story is a tight housing supply, but there may be some other tools to help bring down housing costs. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you struggling to find affordable housing? How has the housing market affected where you live, where you want to live, where you can afford to live? Do you rent properties to others? If so, what do you see driving the cost of rents for you right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Chris Kirko is the founder of Milwaukee Community Land Trust and the president of Housing for All. He recently wrote an op-ed for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about inflation and the increasing cost of rent. Chris, welcome to Central Time.
My pleasure.
Also with us, Kaya Fox, executive director of Habitat for Humanity in La Crosse. Kaya, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you, Rob.
In the last few years, Kaya, how has the cost of renting changed here in Wisconsin?
Well, we've seen an increased burden, especially for low-income families, on the amount of their monthly income that they're paying on rent. And we all know that when we pay more for our rent, that means less money for all those other important things that we see. So in the United States, or in the state of Wisconsin itself, we have about 1 in 10 households are actually paying more than half of their income before taxes on their rental payments.
Chris, in that op-ed I mentioned in the Journal Sentinel, you talk about the connection between rising rent prices and inflation, and that a lot of the headlines about inflation are overlooking the factor of rent. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, of course. So the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel recently cited a firm called Dwellzy, and according to their data set, there's been a 13% increase in rents in the La Crosse area in the last 12 months, 18% increase in rents in the Milwaukee area, and across the United States, a 26% increase. So rent control can kind of seem like an unfair solution, but I mean, right, nobody can defend rents going up by 26%. That is a fundamentally broken system. And then if we look at some data from the federal government, this is coming from before we're having our current bout of inflation. From 1985 to 2020, rents have increased at 4 times faster than incomes. Four times faster than incomes, your rent has gone up. All the while, the United States' largest corporate landlords are making record-breaking profits, right? So Mid-America, they had $430 million in profits in 2020, and that's profits, not revenue. That was a 60% increase from their profits in 2019. Rents are going up, so fast, and I'm here to say that the answer is rent control.
We'll get into rent control in just a minute. Kaya, what do you see driving, before we get into solutions, what do you see driving the high costs of rent around Wisconsin?
Well, Wisconsin has a lot of tax laws that pass a lot of the costs onto the homeowner, including the landlord, which then gets passed on to the renters. The inflationary increase that we've seen in the last couple of years. And then the other issue is the lack of rental housing, and specifically affordable housing. So there's 120,000 missing low-income affordable rental units in the state of Wisconsin. And so when you've got the supply and demand completely out of balance, it allows for higher rents. And you know, when we see income not keeping up with the cost of the goods that we're buying, including the roofs over our heads, it's becoming a harder and harder balance, specifically for low-income families. But now we're starting to see it moving into, you know, middle America are having a harder and harder time paying for the roof over their heads.
We are talking to Kaya Fox, Executive Director of Habitat for Humanity in La Crosse, and Chris Kirko, founder of the Milwaukee Community Land Trust, looking at the cost of rent around Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guests, maybe your own experiences. Are you seeing rent become less and less affordable over time? If you rent to others, what is driving costs? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Chris, you mentioned rent control. This is not a familiar concept in Wisconsin because you can't do it in Wisconsin. Can you let people know what rent control means?
Sure. Yeah. So there's actually there's really countless different ways that you can make a rent control law. So you can limit the amount that rent can be increased. You can calculate what is the cost of actually running a rental property, and then base the rent level off of that. There's really limitless different ways that this can be done. So in the United States, we just kind of have this assumption that rent control is just such a bad idea. But we actually see rent control all over the world and different examples of how it can be done. So looking at a study of 38 wealthy democracies, a majority had some form of rent controls. And so it might be common sense that rent controls don't work, but we have real world proof that rent controls do work, and they do work very well.
And one of the concerns is that, that doesn't allow landlords to keep up with the costs of rent. We heard on the Ideas Network Facebook page, Mark writes, as a landlord, costs such as property casualty insurance have gone up 20%. Property taxes are up 10%. Maintenance, landscaping are up. They all get passed on to the tenants. So in a situation of rent control, a property owner might not be able to afford that stuff. What do you think, Chris?
Sure. So, I mean, I like to take a very big picture view, and to say that in countries like Austria or Germany or the Netherlands that have really good housing systems, we don't have these problems. Like those, the, that's just not a you know those aren't that's not a problem that they see there. So to take a really wide view and say, okay, maybe rent control on its own wouldn't solve this problem, and that's absolutely true. But we know that it can work. It can be part of reforming our housing system of a few different things that we have to do. And we just know from real world experience that this really can work.
Kaya, do you have solutions in mind that you would point to in the La Crosse area or beyond?
Oh, absolutely. So when you work in affordable housing, there's so many different things that you can look at within your community and then within your state and within the federal level on addressing the affordable housing gaps that we have and the rent prices that we see. Locally, you can take a look at your zoning laws that maybe prohibit the development of affordable housing developments or make it harder. Local municipalities should really take a close look at what they're writing into their zoning laws that are making it more and more difficult for folks to be building affordable housing in their communities. Also, taking a look at comprehensive plans, as the communities are putting together their vision of the future, taking a look at how housing development has changed over time and how density has maybe lowered over the years, and find ways that we can right size, right price housing in our communities. And then also taking a look at laws at the state level and how are they prohibitive of, making sure that the citizens in your community are finding rental units that are affordable to you. So what are the different laws at the state level that say it's difficult to, follow up with landlords or do any inspections on the properties when they're coming under disrepair? And so if we just need a more educated community that understands that affordable housing isn't a bad word. It's a great opportunity for communities. It helps the local economy. And when we talk about, taxes and insurance prices going up, when you build more new and affordable homes in your community, that helps curb some of those other kind of secondary responses that come with lack of affordable housing.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hello. Yeah, rent caps are a terrible idea. No one, no landlord really wants to raise his rent. If you lose a tenant for a couple months trying to find someone who you don't know how it's going to work out, it's a loss. No one really wants to do that. No one wants to be the bearer of bad news. It's not this greedy society. It's all about how much money you have to spend and what is your return on the property. It's that simple. I mean, if you're going to put a cap on it, then you're going to get less quality in rental units. People are going to buy the cheapest stuff, the stuff that's peeling, the one coat of paint. That's what you're going to be living in. I mean, when you get a bigger government with bigger taxes and more expensive and maybe a mismanagement of the government, I mean, more government certainly isn't going to help.
Jim, thanks for the call. Chris?
Sure. So, I mean, so number one, like, let's not lose sight that there are countries that have extremely high rental, extremely high quality rental housing, and they have rent controls, and they can make it work. So I mean, we know that this can work. Now, someone that part of what we do is we interview people who struggle with housing, and someone that we had been talking to. She was living in the Waukesha County area, and her building got bought out, and she said that twice a year they would inspect the heating, once a year they would inspect the air conditioning. This new landlord, right, raised the rents by $400 a month and stopped doing the normal inspections and cleaning of the filters of the heating and the air conditioning. I mean, it's just not true that. I mean, in Milwaukee, we have no rent controls and we have notoriously low quality rental housing. There is not a relationship between rent controls and landlords, you know, not maintaining their properties.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Chris Kirko, founder of the Milwaukee Community Land Trust and president of Housing for All, and Kaya Fox, executive director of Habitat for Humanity in La Crosse, with us today to talk about the increasing cost of rental properties, how they're hoping to drive those costs back down. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Share your experiences as a renter, as a property owner or manager. What do you think of the idea of rent control? Currently, you can't do it in Wisconsin because of state law. Do you think communities should be able to do that? How would you like to see it work? If so, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Chris Kirko, founder of the Milwaukee Community Land Trust, president of Housing for All, and Kaya Fox, executive director of Habitat for Humanity in La Crosse, looking at the impact of inflation on rental costs. What can be done to bring rising rent prices back down? You could join in with your experiences, maybe your solutions, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Michael is with us in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Rob. So I've been a renter for about the last 15 years, and I wanted to call in based on some of what I heard the previous caller saying about, you know, get a single coat of paint and et cetera. You know, from my perspective, that's what we already have, you know, with the current system, with, you know, individuals or private companies buying up hundreds and hundreds of rental properties and, you know, barely administering to them beyond what they're legally required to do. That's what we already have. People are motivated by profit, and they're going to give the bare minimum to their tenants that they can. And that's already what's happening. So I don't know. That's just my perspective that I want to share.
Michael, thanks a lot for calling. Kaya, have you seen that larger landlords, as Michael says, maybe being less responsive?
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that we see a lot in the work that we do with affordable housing is, you know, not only is the rent high, but the units that folks are living in are substandard. There's a lot of different issues with the properties. And, you know, that's one of the struggles that we see is that not only are the costs going up, but the condition of the units that people are living in are going down. So it's a lose-lose situation. And that's why we need to take a look at solutions that create more access to affordable housing for individuals, because rising tides will raise ships. And when we have, you know, a choice of great units for low-income families in our communities, then landlords who put the coat of paint on the wall and make the bare bones minimum repairs are going to be required to maybe make some more investments in their properties. Those property values are going to go up. The share of taxes that people have to, you know, bear will start going down. And in the long run, everybody's going to be better off.
Thanks for that call. Let's go to Gary now in De Pere. Hi, Gary.
Well, hi.
What did you want to bring up, Gary?
Well, I just wanted to bring up the fact that the main reason rents are going up is, like we said earlier, is the rental shortage, and then the labor is a big factor as well. I've been in the business for 35 years, and it's very expensive to have things done around the rental properties. The people are just ridiculous at what they're asking. So, you know, I paid $100 an hour for a high school kid to do an hour and a half's worth of work because that's what he wanted. And that saved me a lot of money than having an insured company come in and do it. Nobody came and helped us out when the profits were down or when the rents were low or in 2008 when there was a housing crash. This is one of the times that we're finally riding a high wave. And they'll probably continue until there is some housing that is being built. And that's not going to happen until the prices of materials go down.
Gary, thanks a lot for the call. Chris, Gary sees, you know, there's just not enough housing and the costs a lot to bring labor in to work on what you got.
Sure. So, I mean, one of the things that we talk a lot about is how when there is a shortage of housing, it's a shortfall from the public sector. So our housing system is kind of strange. It's about half of all debt for multifamily apartment buildings is actually owned by the federal government. And the federal government also insures a lot of these mortgages. Our rental housing system appears to be the private market just doing its thing, but it's not. It's subsidized by the federal government to a pretty amazing extent. And so these problems can be solved. We are the richest, most powerful country in the history of the world. Materials might be expensive. They're not always going to be. Labor might be expensive, but I mean, we can solve these problems. We are rich enough that we can do this. And the investments need to come from the public sector because really across countries and across history, the private sector simply doesn't build enough housing to keep up. And there needs to be public investment. And I mean, I will say, like, I'm hearing like there are responsible and honest landlords out there. A lot aren't, but there are. And when they struggle, kind of Vienna is like one of my favorite housing systems, but they spent a lot of money helping private landlords get their, so when they were doing this, right, there was like no running water in a lot of Viennese apartment buildings. And so the city actually spent a great deal of money helping bring these private for-profit units up to standard. But then in exchange for that help, the landlords, they agreed to rent controls and to other regulations.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Kaya, do you see efforts to just create full-on more housing stock, especially in the La Crosse area?
Yes, I think that's definitely one of the biggest solutions. It's a long-term solution. Unfortunately, you know, housing takes up about a third of the structures that we use to calculate inflation, but it's one of the long-term solutions in order to start seeing things go in the other direction. So, you know, obviously building a house takes time, it takes a lot of money, it takes a lot of effort, but communities need to start thinking long term when they're thinking about housing in their communities. And so we need to start looking at ways to educate the public that affordable housing is a positive thing for their community. We need to educate, you know, landlords and citizens that by investing in affordable housing, by putting more money into housing in the long run, all of us will benefit. We will all have healthier communities. We'll all have, you know, people who want to move and be part of those communities. And so if we can just start thinking now, you know, as this gap in wage and the lack of housing is getting bigger and bigger, if we can start thinking about solutions now, we're going to be able to avoid some of the disasters that are coming our way.
Time for one more caller. Sandra is with us in Milwaukee. Sandra, hello.
Hello. This is a very interesting program. Thank you very much. I happen to have some knowledge because I have property that I own in Milwaukee, and I have a son who lives in Berlin, Germany, and he owns property that he rents out to tenants. And the difference is pretty amazing. And one of the differences, I could decide tomorrow that I want to raise the rent $500 a month on my tenants. And, you know, they could say, no, I think I'll go elsewhere, or they could take the rent raise, but there's nothing to keep me from determining the price, other than maybe eventually there'll be people who won't move in. My son has a very different situation, which I think probably your guest is familiar with. In Berlin, if you want to raise rent on an existing tenant, you have to show reasonable basis. You have to show that you put in some improvements. You have to show, you know, some other things. But basically, you can't just, you know, wake up one morning and say, I think this is a good figure.
Sandra, thanks for the call. Chris, just a minute left. Could that be a halfway point? Yes, you can raise rent, but you got to tell us why.
Sure. So this is quite a coincidence. So on our, you can find us on the web at Housing for Us, which is housing4.us. But we actually have an interview with a renter in Berlin. And you can compare that to an interview we did with a typical American renter. And we have a lot of from, you know, how can you raise rent? When can a landlord terminate a lease? Things like that, right? This woman lived for more than 20 years in the same rented apartment, and that's almost unheard of. In the United States, but in countries like Germany, that's possible because, as the caller said, the regulations are much more favorable for tenants. And again, her house is like really big. It's this like historical building. It's a very, very high quality unit of housing, and there's all those regulations that come along with it. That was a great call. Thank you, Sandra.
Sandra, thanks for calling in, and we'll leave it there. Chris, thanks for joining us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
And Kaya, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Chris Kirko, founder of the Milwaukee Community Land Trust, president of Housing for All. He recently wrote an op-ed in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about inflation and the rising costs of rent. And Kaya Fox is executive director of the Habitat for Humanity in La Crosse. Chris and Kaya were with us today to talk about rising housing prices and what they believe are potential solutions to bringing some of those costs down. Still time for you to share your thoughts, your experiences over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, dig into the latest research and news about e-cigarettes and vaping, how it affects lungs, the impact they have on younger users. You can share your stories and your questions. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7. That's here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6, it was last changed 30 years ago. Whether it's the ERA, abortion, guns, or the Electoral College, there's an appetite to update the Constitution. Others say, leave it alone. What, if anything, should our next constitutional amendment be? That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, a lot of us like to laugh at comedy, but not all jokes are funny to everyone. There have been some recent controversies over material from comics like Dave Chappelle and Ricky Gervais, accused of crossing a line on issues affecting transgender people. These questions aren't new, from minstrel shows of the 1800s to a dust-up over comedians like Andrew Dice Clay in the 1980s. There's been a long back and forth over comedy that addresses race, LGBTQ issues, religion, and more. Comedians like to push boundaries, and comedy writers today are navigating a line between what's funny and what's offensive. Is everything fair game for comedy, or are there lines that shouldn't be crossed? Want to hear your answers to those questions at 800-642-1234. What do you think makes for good comedy? Do you have a line you draw between funny and offensive? Should comedians just target, go after whatever they want? Or is there something that you say, you know what, I'm done? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Scott Dickers is a comedy writer and a founding editor of the satirical news outlet The Onion, born here in Wisconsin. He's a New York Times bestselling author of multiple books, including How to Write Funny, creator of Jim's Journal, and he was previously an intern for The Larry Miller Show on Wisconsin Public Radio. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rob. It's delightful to be back here.
Good to have you back. Now, you've been writing comedy for years and years, sometimes, I imagine, in a room by yourself, sometimes in a writer's room.
Sometimes in a room right there at Wisconsin Public Radio at night.
Yeah. Oh, really? Okay. Now, when you're working with other writers, I mean, how have you talked over the years about these issues? Like, is this crossing a line? Are we offending people? Should we worry about if we're offending people? What kind of conversations have you had over the years?
Oh, so many. So, we don't really talk about a line necessarily, I guess. That's a word a lot of people use. Mm-hmm. I think of this old phrase that came from journalism, which was comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And this is what I always talk to people about when they're doing comedy. We all know the whole idea of you shouldn't punch down. The other side of that equation is you should punch up. So you should make fun of the established power structures, politicians, you know, any kind of institution that is lording over us in one way or another. But if it ever feels like you're punching down, if you're making fun of a victim, if you're ridiculing a disenfranchised group or anything like that, audiences will not like the joke. Now, does that mean all audiences are part of the woke left? Kind of. Like, that's kind of the rule. So you can feel it in an audience. And obviously, if you're writing comedy and putting it on a website, you don't see the audience. But you get letters and you get a sense of it. And audiences are progressive by nature. They don't like to see people kicked while they're down. So that's why people like Dave Chappelle are getting so much heat for the trans material, because, I mean, that wasn't really even jokes. You know, there are trans comedians who do trans jokes, and they're making fun of themselves, their predicament. They're doing it in a knowing way. But if you're going to go on stage like he did and say that trans people literally don't exist, it's offensive to anyone with half a sense of, you know, civility or community, that these are legitimate human beings and we should allow them to have their experience. If you're not doing that, then a lot of people are not going to like what you're doing. And, you know, you can cross those lines. You can do that. It's a choice you make. There might be some people who enjoy it, a small minority of people who are going to laugh right along with you. But the majority of the audience is going to be feeling a little icky when you do that.
Now, with the Dave Chappelle comedy special in particular, it got a lot of views on Netflix. It seemed like it went pretty well. And, you know, maybe some of that was, yeah, maybe I'm uncomfortable with those bits. But overall, Dave Chappelle is pretty funny, so I'll ride it out. I mean, it doesn't seem like he paid a huge cost for that material.
No, he's Dave Chappelle, so he's fine. You know, if you're a comedian starting out and you go out there and do that, you're going to get booed off the stage because they don't like you yet. So he operates by a different set of rules, and that's just the way it is. You know, I'm sure he would tell you that he has gotten a lot of heat because he probably never hears the end of it. You know, it caused a lot of controversy. Netflix had to step in, and it was just a really unfortunate mess. So, yeah, he did fine at the end of the day. And that's kind of what I'm saying. It's like you make the choice. And if you're going to kick someone who's down, in other words, make fun of a disenfranchised group. But again, he didn't even really make fun of the group. He basically said he doesn't believe they exist. So that's a really insensitive thing to say. And you're going to have people complaining. And like I said, you're also going to have people who don't care, who don't mind, who say, he's funny, you know, I'll take the rest of it. And that's a choice that every comedian, comedy writer has to make. And you have to make it based on how well do people already like me? How much capital do I have to expend on this? You know, The Onion was around for a long time when we put out a really offensive tweet, and people were really, you know, offended and got a lot of angry letters, got a lot of media attention. But The Onion had been around for like 25 years at that point. It's not going to ruin us. You know, we can handle it. We'll move on. People will forget. But if you're just starting out, you can't really afford to do that. Or if you just met someone, you're telling a joke in mixed company, you know, good luck to you.
Talking to Scott Dickers, founder of The Onion, a New York Times bestselling author of books, including How to Write Funny, looking at comedy and when people take offense at a comedian, at comedy writing. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts. Are there comedians or shows, TV shows or whatever, that turned you away because of something they did? Is there something you tolerated in spite of it? Or do you not worry about it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I want to give a listen to Rowan Atkinson, known as Mr. Bean and Blackadder from a couple of well-known British comedy series. He made the case in an interview here with Ireland AM that it's the job of comedy to offend, that every joke has a victim. Here's a listen.
I'm a great believer that artists should never apologize for their art. You put something out there, you paint a watercolor, you make a joke, you make a television show, whatever it is. If people are offended, That's their problem. It's not yours. You've done your bit. If they don't want you to work for them again, then that's, you know, that may become your problem, but you've done your bit and you've done your best, and it's up to the audience to judge.
So you put it out there into the world and don't really worry, I guess, about that, the response people might have. Scott, what do you think?
Well, no, every comedian worries, and I know he worries, and it's a sexy thing to say in an interview, but I can't remember anything Rowan Atkinson has ever done that made me bristle and think, ooh, that was over the line, because he's very good. He's one of our better comedians and comic writers. So, yeah, I basically agree in principle that, yeah, you can put out anything you want, but any comedian or any comedy writer is going to think about the consequences. They're going to think, are people going to accept this? Because comedy doesn't, it's not a one-way street. Comedy requires an audience. It's not art. So in that way, I would disagree with him. Comedy is entertainment. If the audience doesn't laugh, it's not funny and it doesn't work. So you need that audience to like what you're doing. Again, if you wanted to be really offensive and you want to cross lines all day, you might get a small sliver of the audience who thinks you're just great. And if you want to, you know, appeal to that niche, that's your option. Like he said, you can put it out there and you do your best. But I do agree with him that I don't think a comedian should ever apologize for their work. I hate that idea. Like, yeah, if someone is offended, it truly is their fault. On the same side of that coin, the comedian has a responsibility to try to entertain and make the audience laugh, as opposed to bristle with offense in large.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, I agree that the best comedy addresses the people, the audience, if you can gauge how the audience is feeling. I have two examples I'd like to share. We had a comedian come to the Tri-State Fair years ago in Douglas County. And he was looking at, you know, hundreds of people, and he said, you know, Superior seems like a pretty nice place when they finally get it finished. And everybody laughed because there was road construction and everything going on. And everybody thought that was funny. And there was another time at the cathedral where the priest it was 100 degrees out. Everyone was fanning. We didn't have air conditioning. And the priest said during his homily, this was the shortest homily I ever heard. He goes, well, it's hotter in hell. Let's rise and profess our faith. And everybody laughed. But it was, you know, addressing the audience and how the audience was feeling.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Scott, I guess reading the room in some ways and having fun with what you know your audience is.
Yeah, any kind of, you know, one thing that always kills on stage is making fun of the place you're at. Because people love to hear their city or their state made fun of, you know, good-natured ribbing.
Jeff, thanks for that call. We are talking to Scott Dickers, from the founding editor of The Onion, longtime comedy writer, looking at modern comedy, the line between funny and offensive. And still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Have your comedic sensibilities changed over the years? Do you ever go back and listen to stuff from when you were a kid and laugh, cringe, maybe both at the same time? Are there things for you that you're like, nope, that's too far, I don't like that bit, or I'm done with this comedian or this show or this author, or you name it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with Scott Dickers. He's a comedy writer and author who helped found the satirical news outlet The Onion here in Wisconsin, with us today looking at how comedians and comedy writers navigate modern sensibilities between what's funny and what's harmful in comedy. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Who are some of your favorite comedians? How do they walk the line, if they do, between funny and offensive? Do you like comedy that pushes the boundaries? Or do you think there's some boundaries you'd rather not see pushed? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Scott, I'm thinking back at an older example with what you were saying earlier about, if you're saying things that are offensive and how it'll affect your audience. I want to go back to like the minstrel shows of the 1800s, early 1900s, where, you know, it's white people in blackface enacting stereotypes of black people for other white people. And I'm guessing some of the white audiences found it hilarious. And then the comedians there got, you know, big laughs from the white audience and didn't really, nobody really thought about what it said about the black people that were being made fun of.
No, Amos and Andy was one of the more popular radio shows, and they went on TV. Like, they were playing that on old time radio in my lifetime. So there's a thing about comedy that if you're not very aware of all of the various audiences that you're performing to or writing to, your comedy might not age well. So back then they were figuring, well, our audience is white people, so we're going to make fun of black people and the white audience will enjoy that. Everybody will be happy. Then we sort of expand it's like the analogy would be the expanding the circle of liberty. You know, we're expanding the audience. So, okay, if black people are part of the audience, maybe you don't want to make fun of black people in these stereotypical ways because now they're part of the audience. And then in the 70s, 80s, we had a lot of like gay humor making fun of gay men. And that was like go-to. We had Three's Company, you know, gay joke after gay joke. That kind of fell out of fashion in the 90s, I would say, when gay men started to become enveloped in that expanding circle of liberty or audience. And we keep expanding that. And so now the most marginalized group is trans people. And so that's why we have a lot of these issues. If you notice, like in the 80s and 90s, the biggest laugh you could get on Saturday Night Live was two men kissing. People are laughing. It's so outrageous. Oh my God, can you imagine two men kissing? Then they realize, oh, you know, there are actually men in our audience who like kissing men. And they don't like that joke because we're mocking this thing that they're literally trying to get the right to legally marry someone. And they get that right. Of course, it's probably going to get rolled back any day now here. But now it's not funny. You don't see that performed anymore. But trans people have not achieved that station that gay men have achieved. So you can make fun. Actually, it's less now in mainstream comedy. But I would say in the aughts, between 2000, 2010, you would see a lot of transphobic humor, much like you saw gay humor in the 80s and 90s. And I've always endeavored to do comedy at The Onion that was, you know, just a little more woke. Like, you want to be perceived as being no holds barred. You know, you'll make fun of everybody, equal opportunity offender. But again, if you're kicking people who are down and you're making fun of a group as if that group isn't in the room, it's not going to age well. So, you know, The Onion's had its fair share of gay jokes, trans jokes, et cetera, but we're never making fun of them like they're not in the room. We're having fun with them, and they're part of the humor. And that's the kind of humor that ages well.
A lot of the response to criticism of comedy that transgresses some of those rules that kicks down, I guess, centers around the phrase cancel culture. That, okay, if I can't do whatever comedy I want to do, you're taking something away from me. What do you make of that, the rise of this concept of, this isn't just in comedy, obviously, but the rise of the concept of cancel culture as it relates to comedy?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a huge range. You know, there's the cancel culture where someone applies for a job and then their boss finds out that they wrote an offensive joke 20 years ago, so they don't hire them or they fire them right away. You know, that's, I think, the example of cancel culture that everyone kind of doesn't like and wishes would go away. But then there's, you know, somebody like Louis C.K. who, you know, sexually assaulted all these comedians who he had in a room with him, who look up to him and who thought he was going to be giving them comedy career advice. And so someone like that, I think it's fair that, like for me, like I have a hard time watching his comedy now because anytime he does a joke about masturbation, which he does a lot of them, I can't help but picture that. And it's an icky feeling. So like Louis C.K. kind of ruined Louis C.K. for me. And does that equal canceling? I don't know. I think it's just consequences for behavior that we used to tolerate that now we realize is something we shouldn't tolerate. You know, Harvey Weinstein should have gotten canceled. I think that's a good cancellation. But yeah, should we cancel people because they told an insensitive joke a few years ago? No, I don't think you should ever cancel people for their art or their creativity. And I would be the last person to hold a grudge against somebody who wrote a joke 20 years ago and forbid them from getting a job. But if somebody's actually raping people in their spare time, totally different. Cancel them.
Talking to Scott Dickers, founding editor of The Onion, looking at comedy, when funny becomes offensive, how people in the business, comedy writers and comedians handle these issues. Scott, I read something on your blog, your How to Write Funny blog. It wasn't talking about this in particular, but I thought it fit pretty well. The idea of, hey, the internet, people are writing jokes all the time. If you are trying to be the first one to respond with this obvious joke, somebody's probably going to beat you to it. I think about this with, you know, if your jokes are the stereotype, the same, you know, Don Rickles Polish joke or whatever back then, or the same gay joke in the 1980s or whatever, it's not that original. You're kind of doing the same shtick as everybody else. Does this kind of thing lead to just bad and lazy comedy too?
Yeah, it can. Just not being original is really the greatest sin that a comedian or a comedy writer can commit. So having a unique voice and having, you know, is like having a unique fingerprint. So if you know who you are as a comedian, what your comedic voice is, you almost can't help but be original. If you're just writing the same hack jokes that everybody else is writing, yeah, chances are somebody's going to write that same joke and beat you to it nowadays. You can't win.
Are there things that, you know, when you came into the business X number of years ago, you look back and think, I might have done things differently now knowing what I know?
I mean, there were certainly mistakes made and we told a lot of offensive jokes that maybe today I wouldn't make. But when you're starting out, you kind of have to make those mistakes. You have to figure out where your comfort ends. And so I don't regret that because it certainly taught us a lot to make a lot of offensive jokes, you know, and to almost get sued by certain people for making fun of them or making fun of their companies or whatever. There's a good amount of that in The Onion's history. So I can't say that I would do anything differently because you got to learn that stuff. You got to kind of explore and see what works for you and what works for your voice and what the audience will tolerate. So again, that makes it even more difficult for the beginner comedian who's just starting out. You know, they kind of have to be the safest because if they make a mistake, it's really easy for their confidence to dry up or for their career to fizzle or for them to not get booked. But if they're established, they've been around for 20 years, you know, Louis C.K. still has a career. You know, he's got plenty of people who don't mind what he did and are happy to buy his stuff. I see him in a lot fewer TV shows and I see him talked about a lot less and he is kind of marginalized, but he's doing fine because he's got that reputation. He's got that long history and he's established himself.
Scott, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Scott Dickers, comedy writer, founding editor of the satirical news outlet, The Onion. He's the author of several books and offers courses on comedy through his website, howtowritefunny.com. He was with us today to share how comedians and comedy writers like him toe the line between funny and offensive. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a new U.S. Supreme Court ruling will limit the EPA's authority to stop climate change emissions. We'll find out what's changed and what kind of tools are still on the table after that ruling. And firearms labeled as assault weapons were banned for a 10-year period in the United States. We'll look at the impact of the ban at the time and the recent wave of public shootings using similar weapons. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.